You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Megan Cox Gooden.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories, the podcast where we bring you the story behind the stories and the storyteller. Author interviews, writing advice, book reviews, all sorts of great stuff. If you are a book lover, Author Stories is the place for you. We have more than 550 author interviews in our archives at HankGarner.com. Please go over there and check it out. Also, check out our YouTube channel, where we also have all of the episodes archived there. If you don't find an author interview that you're looking for on the website, click on the Archives tab. There's a long list of them where you can click and download and listen right there. I'd like to tell you about some sponsors that make the show possible. Missing Wings by Andrea Luman. Born with an ability, the Viladi people of Madar believe make her one of the first to be blessed by God. Katrina's destiny unravels when her father is poisoned and her mother steals her into the human world to hide among those who hate her kind. In a near-fatal attempt to return home, Katrina is stripped of her wings. The poison meant to kill her father leaves him in a degenerative state. When her eldest brother discovers she has survived, he orders her to stay in hiding. She must wait, concealed in the human world, until the danger of their father's uncontrolled rage is contained. Grown and adapted to the human world, Katrina encounters one of her kind. The promise of home and first love leads her into a situation capable of starting war among the Vilid. Will a human upbringing, mistakes, and the loss of her abilities bar her from reclaiming her heritage? Will unraveling the mystery of her mother's betrayal lead her family into even greater danger? Missing Wings by Andrea Luman. There's a link to it in the show notes. Devin Ford, Recon, the expansion series book one. Hundreds of years in Earth's future sees the United Global Territories striving to colonize the Moon and Mars. The discovery of a clean energy source ended the world's reliance on fossil fuels overnight, and years after the resulting wars, a new discovery puts the tenuous world peace at risk, that of faster-than-light travel. With humanity on the verge of traveling to new solar systems and all the humanitarian and scientific possibilities involved, a discovery by the reconnaissance team turns everything upside down. Join the small team of the reconnaissance mission who fight friend and foe to complete their mission objectives, no matter where it leads them or what the personal cost. Devin Ford, Recon, the Expansion Series, Book 1. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. You guys, today I'm super excited to have Megan Cox Gerdinen on the show with me today. Megan has a fantastic book called The Enchanted Hour, The Miraculous Power of Reading Aloud in the Age of Distraction. Megan, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Megan, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Okay. I think that it dates back to when I was, it may have predated the age of 11, but I know for sure that at 11, that's when the bug bit hard. That was the year my father moved up to Maine, bought some land. He quit his corporate job, bought some land and started building a house. And I went up to visit him, and there was a used bookstore in a little town near where he lived, and we happened to be passing through, and an aunt of mine who was also visiting. I'm sorry, this is a very long story, but there you go. the way of these vivid memories. I remember, you know, you can remember the slanting of the sun.
We love long stories.
She picked this rather mangy looking book, which didn't have a dust jacket on it anymore. Pressed it to her heart and said, you have to read this. This is the book you have to read. And I still have that edition today of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith. And it is, you know, it's of course one, I think it's in fact considered one of the one of the great novels of the 20th century. And for me, the book has just almost impossible resonance through my life, through my family, through my way, in fact, of even seeing the world. And so she gave me this book, and it's, you know, at 11, it was daunting, and there were a lot of things in the book that I didn't understand the first time I read through, and not even the third or fourth or fifth time I read through. And now as an adult, I see how much of the, you know, texture of life Betty Smith was able to weave in this beautiful, clear language. And at any rate, as you may remember or may know, that the main character of the book, Francie Nolan, loves to read and loves to write and wants to be a writer and sees the world as a writer does. And the book in some ways is like her coming of age as a writer. I mean, there are all sorts of things, other things that happen in it, but the way that her, you know, the way that she processes the events of her life, the way that she chooses one way of describing, for instance, her father, and not ways that might be more realistic, but ways in which that ennoble him. So all of this, this is kind of a long-winded, very long-winded way of saying that it was that book, having that book pressed into my hands, that I think of as the sort of generative moment for me as a writer.
I love that the story resonated so deeply with you and stayed with you. But I also love that it was given to you, by someone, that you loved and respected, and that the act of giving it, had as much of an impact as probably the story did.
Oh, I think that's so important. You know, I think that being able to receive from others the things that they have loved, you know, Wordsworth has a line about that. What others have loved, we will love. What we have loved, others will love, and we will show them how. You know, that's so true. And I receive from others books that have, for instance, the Narnia books also. Many of us had the experience of being given the Narnia books and feeling, you know, this intense personal connection, not just with the books, but with the people who gave you the books. And then we pass them on. You know, there's this lovely kind of river of literature that flows along. But we have to, you know, we have to make the effort to pass things on. They get lost otherwise.
Oh, man. So you have this experience at your dad's house with your aunt, and she passes on this book. Mm-hmm. How long does it take before you start commiserating with the main character, and you want to start writing for yourself?
Oh gosh! Well, I think in fact I had written before then. It was more that the example of Francie kind of crystallized the thing. You know, interesting. I came across a little short story that I'd written when I was probably around that age the other day, and read it to my youngest daughter, who's now 13. Where it's wandered off. I wish I could find it and read it to you. It's quite amusing. It was about me as a bank robber, and I had there's a particular line that I remember being extremely pleased with as a child, which was that I had my trusty gun at my side. I mean, you know, I think so many of us, we start out writing in a kind of pastiche of other people's phrases and styles. And if we're lucky, you know, at some point our style becomes our own. I used to write an online kind of series of, well, it was sort of a weekly sketches about family life. It was called The Fever Swamp.
I love that name.
Well, this was derived from an expression a friend of mine said to me when I had, I think, four children at the time. And he said, you know, one child is busy and two children is hectic, and more than two children is the fever swamp. So it seemed like a, you know, a good encapsulation of what life was. Yeah, you know, immensely hectic.
Well, my wife and I have five kids. We have been in the fever swamp for about 23 years.
Oh, same for me then. I've been in it for 24. I also have five kids. That's great. Yeah.
Nice. No,
it's lovely. It's, I wouldn't choose any other life. It wasn't the life I expected, and I'm really glad I have it.
That's right. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. I mentioned, just to go back quickly though, I mentioned the fever swamp column because, at one point, this was, you know, in some ways, it was sort of early. It was would have been in the early 2000s, maybe 2003, 2004. And I was I discovered belatedly after I'd been writing the column for about 6 months that I had a couple of sort of online imitators who were very cruel, very unkind, really hated me. And I was feeling extremely sad about it and felt, you know, with every word that I wrote, I felt sort of hag-ridden, as though there were this mocking character sitting on my shoulder making fun of everything I was saying. And a friend of mine, also a writer, was very encouraging. He said, look, if you didn't have your own style and voice, there wouldn't be something for them to imitate. So be happy about that. And I thought, okay, I'll be happy about that.
Love that. You have been writing for quite a while, doing writing essays, book reviews. Did you intend to be a literary journalist and reviewer and opinion maker when you set out?
You know, I didn't, although it's really interesting in hindsight to look back at the, you know, earlier phases in my career. When I lived in New York when I was younger, right out of college. And I remember at the time I was working, actually I was working in television for the Wall Street Journal of all things, very much desiring to go out into the world and be a foreign correspondent. That was my great ambition at the time. But what I really enjoyed reading were, I loved reading literary criticism. So I would read a lot of it at home. And then, but my stated and felt desire was to go out into the world and, you know, and go and do some pounding the pavement and go and see things and write about them. And I remember feeling torn, you know, in the way that when you're say 23, 24, you just want to do everything. And I thought, well, one has to focus, one has to do one thing. And so I'm going to really go for being a foreign correspondent. But interesting, right? That after I began having children and foreign reporting was just really very arduous and impossible. And in fact, kind of very dangerous and not such a great idea for someone with children at home, at least in my case. The opportunity came up to start writing criticism. And so now when I look back, it all makes perfect sense. It was though, you know, various seeds were being planted, but the flowers didn't begin coming up until the time was right.
And everything has a season. I think that's one thing we lose track of is we want all the things and we want all the things now. And really things really do have a proper season.
It is so absolutely true. And in fact, you know, I mean, for the last, 15, 20 years, I've watched as many of my friends and acquaintances have written books of their own. And I used to beat myself up about it. But I had, at one point I was writing 3 columns a week for several years. I had 5 little children, was writing 3 newspaper columns a week, and I was beating myself up because this is the way of woman, maybe it's also the way of man, that I wasn't also producing some kind of, you know, book. Well, you know, as you say, there is a season and it came round and here I am. And I do think it's a shame really that the wisdom that one acquires it in mid-50s, which is where I am, couldn't have been accessed earlier. But the trouble is, I think one is kind of deaf to it when you're younger. So when people say, you know, older people say, take your time, you know, all in good time. You think, no, it's never going to happen.
That advice is so hard to swallow in your 20s.
No, impossible. I mean, you're just on fire for life. You want it all to be happening now. But you know, isn't it interesting though, too? Sometimes you can look back and you see that the people whom you admired or who seemed to be right at the pinnacle of their careers when they're in their early 20s, you know, that's hard for them too. They have that early glory, but it doesn't always last. And, you know, there's something to be said for parceling out the victories, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Can we talk about the subject of literary criticism for just a moment?
For sure.
I feel like that we've kind of lost the plot on criticism at this point. I think when people think of literary criticism or critiques or reviewing, we kind of go to what we see daily on Amazon reviews or Goodreads review, or really just kind of anything on the internet now, where everyone can post their opinion, and usually they are all 5 stars or all 1 stars, and we have lost the ability to honestly give an opinion or an experience with a piece of work. And either we love it, we hate it, but we don't really know anymore how to take a critical look, pick out the good, pick out the bad. Why does this resonate with me? Why does it not? What do you feel about that? And what do you think the role, the proper role of literary criticism is?
Oh, these are good questions. It's very, very difficult, I think. I find it incredibly difficult, and I do it as a job. You know, it's never not difficult. I have sat, in the early days, so I've been reviewing, these are children's books, but, there's an awful lot of artistry and thought that goes into them.
I would think that would be doubly hard.
Well, they need to be taken seriously. I think they should be taken seriously.
Sure.
And I do take them seriously. But, just in simply finding the language to convey how one picture book is different from another picture book, it is immensely challenging. And one has to sometimes, I have sat for inordinate periods of time holding books, looking at them, and trying to draw out from myself what it is about the book that makes it worth talking about. Sometimes it's screamingly obvious, of course, but sometimes there is an elusive quality, some kind of deep beauty that is really, really difficult to articulate. You feel the resonance with it, or you feel the resonance from it, or in you, I guess, from it when you're in the presence of the book. But to convey what the feeling is to someone who is flipping through their newspaper and their eye, dashing down the page, it's a very strenuous art. I think also, I have to say that I do struggle with something else on this, and that is to be truthful. And I'm making myself a hostage to fortune by saying that, I suppose. But I really respect the amount of work that goes into creating a book. And now that I've done it myself, I have even more of a kind of an honest and as, I don't know, daunted respect for it. But at the same time, one has to be able to be truthful about what one sees. And there is, in my world of children's books, there is an enormous amount of propaganda and politicization. And if I spend all my time, as it were, calling that out, I'm not doing my job of helping people find things that are perhaps either less political or political in the way that they want to find them. At any rate, there are a great many elements that come to bear in assessing a book. And in fact, in choosing which books are written about and which ones I just, move on from. So I don't know that I'm really answering your question, except to say that, there are a number of disciplines that are brought to bear, and discipline is painful and hard. And so it is tempting to go the easy route. So in fact, what you were describing, the 5-star reviews or the 1-star reviews, those don't require discipline. You know what I mean?
Right.
They just require an excessive feeling. And that is something we are not in short supply of today. What we are in short supply of is judicious assessment and people not setting their hair on fire over every little thing, whether enthusiastically or, with condemnation. I want to say one other thing. There's a kind of gushing quality that pervades the book industry. If anyone's gushing about my book, it's obviously appropriate, and I encourage that.
But yes.
People will, in praising each other's books, they'll say, "This book tore me apart and devastated me, and then put me back together again." And I think, that's phony. Do you know what I mean? That may be Dostoevsky, maybe Tolstoy, maybe, the great stylists and the best storytellers of all time. Maybe you could say that, but come on,
what is the best, using your own words, what is the best endorsement for a book, that one should give. If we need to really take a critical eye, if we shouldn't gush like that, what would be the best endorsement?
Oh, goodness me. Well, I mean, so here's something that I think gets neglected when people are making endorsements. And that is the idea of literature itself, the canon of literature, the greatest that has been written. That's where we measure ourselves, I think. That's how we should be. That's how books should be measured. And I think that, so therefore, they should be measured in some degree for their imperishability, for their transcendence, for the degree to which they deal in specificity and also touch on universality. Because I think that's what the finest literature does. It takes language, manipulates it in effective and marvelous and sometimes apparently effortless ways, although I think there are very few writers who write without effort. I mean, Herman Melville apparently could write at fantastic speeds, and he wrote very entertainingly, so perhaps he didn't have any trouble writing, but most of the rest of us, right? And I don't mean to, I shouldn't say the rest of us as if I'm putting myself in the company of Tolstoy. God, I should only dream. Maybe one sentence one day will measure up. So when we think about how books rate, I do think that an important part of that is how they fit in the constellation of literature as it exists. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. At all costs, we should try to separate ourselves from the passions that make us scream those 1 and 5 star reviews and start taking a deeper look at what we're doing.
Yeah. You know, and also there's just, and this may seem a very superficial thing, but I do notice, and this is an affliction in the children's book world, but perhaps elsewhere as well, that authors will sometimes, in a desire to be, you know, contemporary and to seem fresh and modern and now, build in, for instance, technologies that will be out of date in 2 years. And that there's or brand names, you know, or slang, which is not the slang of, I don't know, it's not slang that's going to, again, it's just going to be kind of, it'll just be obscure and therefore make books inaccessible and odd in the future. I mean, I do think the best books strive for a kind of lasting quality. You know, the effort is made with the prose to make it more than just, you know, a proper noun, verb, you know?
Right.
There is some artistry that goes into it.
Well, and that's the perfect segue to talk about your new book, The Enchanted Hour, The Miraculous Power of Reading Aloud in the Age of Distraction, because we do want to make books more lasting. We want these stories to, especially ones that resonate within us. We go back to talking about sharing those stories like we did in the beginning.
Yeah.
When did this subject really become your passion? And tell us how this kind of got inside you to the point that this was a story in itself that needed to be told.
Oh, sure. You've asked my favorite question of all. This is, of course, if you read the book, which I hope you will, everyone listening, you'll see some of this in the introduction. But essentially, I, like many children, had been read to. I didn't have any memories. I don't really have any memories, except just a tiny trace memories, perhaps, of my grandmother and my mother reading to me, but really not very much. And I happened to be visiting with my then fiancé, a friend who had had babies early. She'd had them right out of college. And she had 3 or 4 little boys at the time that we went to her house for dinner. And while everyone was chatting downstairs, having their gin and tonics or whatever, she excused herself and disappeared. And, you know, the rest of us who were left behind continued chatting. And eventually it became a little awkward. Where had our hostess gone? And someone asked her husband, you know, is everything all right? And he said, oh, yeah. She's just gone to read to the boys. And I have to say, for me, it was like a Damascene moment. It was like a little thunderbolt. I thought, oh gosh, I'd never imagined it. I mean, I must have somewhere in the back of my mind known that reading aloud was something A, valuable, and B, that I would do if I ever had children. But I hadn't until that moment thought, that is something, it's so important that you can put it at the heart of your family life, even when other stuff is going on, even when you have guests over. You put those stories and these children first. And so I resolved in that moment, with that little sort of flash of lightning, that if I ever had children, I would do the same thing. I would make reading aloud the central part of our evenings. And I, at that time, really had no idea that I would even have one child, let alone five. So, of course, I didn't know I was going to have five when I had the one. So as soon as our first daughter was born, we lived in Tokyo at the time, actually. My husband and I came back from the hospital, and it was the absolute first thing I did with her, which is I walked straight into our apartment, walked back with her in my arms to the little nursery we'd rigged up for her, plunked myself down in the rocking chair that I had found on the side of the road and repainted in that, you know, early married thrifty way, and began reading a book of fairy tales to her. I was reading her Cinderella, and it was a very emotional moment because I was, of course, full of, you know, post baby hormones, and so I sat there reading with her and felt absurd. Like, what am I doing? I'm reading to it. She wasn't even awake. Like, she couldn't see the pictures. And I burst into tears, you know, and my husband said, I think you probably should get a little rest. And I did. But that was what I did there, I guess, is I, you know, it was, in fact, the first thing I did upon bringing the baby home. And it did become the absolute heart of our family life. And something that did not make the book, because as a first time author, I let some things slip in earlier drafts. I think I realize now that reading to her taught me how to be a mother. I was an only child from a broken home, as my father likes to joke. I didn't grow up around little children. I didn't have any experience except for a bit of babysitting with little children. I didn't know how to talk to them or what they were interested in, or, you know, how to be. And the books that I would sit and read with this little baby, Molly, you know, week after week, month after month, kind of, they were a kind of tool, right? They allowed me to engage with her in a way that was scripted in a sense. It allowed her to learn how to be with me. It was just this wonderfully formative experience. And then as the years went on, of course, if you have lots of children yourself, you know how this goes. You know, the template was laid, and reading aloud, therefore, it really was the one non-negotiable part of our family. We read every night, and for quite a long time, for years and years and years and years and years. And I'm sorry, I feel like I'm going on and on, but it's just
no. I'm listening
so much.
I'm listening to you and reliving some moments from my kids' childhood, because we had a similar experience. I used to have this giant overstuffed chair, and I would get in the chair, and the kids would just pile on me, and we went through the entire Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah.
We went through the Little House books,
oh, yeah.
Which are amazing books for no matter if you have boys, girls, I feel like we've kind of lost the love of some of those books. And we have some home videos of just stuff going on, you know, the kids playing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so many of those have me or my wife sitting in the chair reading and all the kids around. And every time we watch one of those, like, the kids start talking about, oh, I remember that. Oh, it was so funny when you did that voice. And you know, it's just these magic moments.
Oh, they are actually magic moments. I mean, it is, and you know, when you're doing it, you can feel that something is happening, right? You know, I mean, you know, you say you sit in that chair, there's something incredibly warm about it. You've got the warmth of the physical proximity, and you've got the warmth of the feeling of kind of sort of, you know, engagement with the story, imaginative engagement with the story, and the beauty of the language. No, it's really something. It really is something quite fantastic, and one of the great bonding experiences for families that do it. And yeah, and so and I'll tell you something else, and I'm sure I mean, I don't know that there's any parent who doesn't sometimes feel this way. You think, you know, the day is just hectic and you're getting to the end and you think, oh my God, I still have to read to them. And then you sit down, you finally get everyone bathed and everyone's sitting down. And then it's like, oh, hang on. This is what the whole day is for. This is the moment when the good stuff happens. You know, all that hectic stuff, that's prelude. This is the, you know, this is the real joy of being together as a family. Yeah. So it was, you know, one of the great experiences of my life and continues. I still have one daughter who listens at night. And by amazing coincidence, we are reading A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Oh, I love it. Everything's full circle.
Right. That was not deliberate, by the way. I had actually wanted each child to read it to themselves, because I had such a profound bonding experience with that novel. And my first daughter did. But then the others, there was some reluctance. They hadn't really got round to it. And by the time Flora hit 13, I thought, you know what? I'm just going to read it to you because I can't let you grow up without this book.
Right.
No.
The Locusts, books 1-3 by Ralph Kern. The Complete Locust Series, an epic tale of mystery, survival, exploration, intrigue. The cruise ship MS Atlantica is lost on these strange and uncharted seas, where even the compass shows the sun rising to the west. Atlantica's passengers must do what it takes to survive. The three books, Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Atlantica arrives in a strange new world, unable to locate land and with no way to contact home. They must find new allies, fend off relentless enemies, and discover the horrifying truth behind the Locusts. The Locust box set contains all three action-packed novels in this best-selling science fiction. Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris, acclaimed for great characters, thrilling action, technical accuracy, and a compelling sense of mystery. Buy it today from Ralph Kern, The Locust. The Renegade Star Series, books 1-3 from J.N. Chaney. Jace Hughes is a renegade. That means taking almost any job that comes his way, no matter the situation. So long as he can keep his ship floating, he's free to live the life he wants. But that all changes when he meets Abigail Pryor, a nun looking for safe passage out of the system. Too bad there's something off about the cargo she's carrying. Jace knows he shouldn't ask too many questions, but when odd sounds start coming from inside the large metal box, he can't help but check it. Big mistake. The Renegade Star box set includes the first three books in the series, 900-plus pages, 300-plus five-star reviews. Find out why people are so intrigued by this thrilling science fiction epic. You won't believe the twists and turns the series takes or the secrets that get revealed. The Renegade Star series, get the entire box set on Amazon or the thrilling audiobook from audible.com. There's links to it in the show notes. You know, one thing that was a challenge for me is that I have dyslexia, and I had a hard time with reading when I was little. And you know, as you, if you have a learning challenge like that, you learn little tricks that help you and that make it easier to adjust with. But one thing that I hated, you know, as I went through school, was reading aloud. Mm-hmm. And when you have dyslexia, you have a tendency, your brain gets ahead of itself, mm-hmm. and you'll stumble over words. And it's the most frustrating thing because, you know, I had become an excellent reader, to myself, but then the act of reading aloud just completely jumbled me up. And it's really embarrassing when stuff happens and then, you know, people start correcting you and you're like, no, I know the word. It just came out wrong. You know, but what I found, in reading to my kids is, like everything else in life, it's a developed skill and you get better and better and better at it. And then, especially when you have an engaging book where you can really kind of get into characters and things like that, you start seeing that those things enhance the reading experience, and it becomes as much of a joy for you as it is for the receiver. And this seems to be a common theme in the show. What do you think about that, about the act of reading aloud for the reader, and not just the listener?
Yeah, no, okay, so two things. One is, I mean, I remember very well, I remember the mortification in fourth grade of having to read out loud. I mean, reading out loud for me is one of the great joys of my life, but as you know, I do have a lot of experience now. But yeah, no, that's, I mean, you're so exposed, right? You stand up in front of the class, and it's just you, and any fumble, and everyone hears it, and no, I mean, I think, reading out loud is a wonderful skill. It's a great advantage in life to have. I wish there was some better way that schools could teach it than that very, you know, that so easily shamed position of being out there alone for the mockery of all. I encourage people in the book to do this. You know, it can be a little weird. If you're not accustomed to reading out loud, it can feel very odd to do it. And you can feel maybe some echoes of that, you know, childhood mortification, the fear of laughter or of screwing up the pronunciation or something. And in fact, reading with children, especially young children, is one of the great mercies of it is that they're not going to judge you. They're tucking in and they want to hear and they don't mind. What you're going to say. It's a great way to practice. But, you know, there over time in the past, the oratory and rhetoric were actually regarded as very health-giving practices. And I mentioned in the book that there was a second century Roman doctor named Antyllus, however we would have pronounced him, who prescribed lyric poetry recitation for the good health of his patients. There is an inhabiting of the language that you read when you read, you know, great books aloud. And by great books, I'm not being picky there. I'm just, you know, wonderful stories, whatever. As the reader, there is a kind of a tactile pleasure of forming the words with your lips and saying them with your mouth and hearing your voice in the air. And that it gives pleasure to the listener, you know, that's wonderful too. But there is I liken it actually, to a work of art that you are drawing out of the page through your body and into the air and presenting to the listener. You know, there is something exalted about it. And in fact, you know, I mean, I would say that, practitioners of religion understand the power and beauty and majesty of the word, you know, the word made flesh. I mean, in the beginning was the word. Reading the gospels is part of Christian practice, and reading them out loud is, you know, it's immensely persuasive for people who listen.
Exactly. It really does go deeper than what we can see.
Yeah.
So the book is all about the power of reading and sharing stories in the simplest of ways. What can people expect from the book other than, hey guys, you should be reading to your kids. What is it that as you started, maybe, you know, putting a finer point on this, the things that maybe came to you that you realized were more important or aspects that need to be brought out. I guess what I'm asking is what can people learn from this? You know, other than just the, you know, beating people over the head with, you know, this is what you should be doing. You know, it's, you're not doing this. Therefore our society is dumb.
No, I am not a nag and I'm not a scold. Well, in life I am, but not in the book. I'll tell you, so the book is framed, as you mentioned, with the subtitle is The Miraculous Power of Reading Aloud, and that's what we've been talking about, in the age of distraction. You know, as the years have gone by, I have seen the role that technology, as we all have, right, is playing in family life, in my own experience of the world. I've seen children, you know, go from playing outdoors. You know, I'm as they say, I'm old enough to remember when kids played outdoors after school, and I'm now old enough to have seen what happened when that great switch came, and you know, children are on their technology and that's where they'd prefer to be. And one of the things I explain in the book is that reading aloud is not just this lovely, virtuous, you know, life enhancing practice. It is actually, it is almost literally an antidote for that.
Well, that too.
For the things that are ailing us. You know, technology is sending us all off into our own separate virtual realities. I mean, it's just the truth. You look household after household, people are spending less time in the presence of one another and more time on their screens. When we read together, we put the screens and devices away, we draw back in. And there's a physiological component to that that's very important. You know, we are social animals and we need to be physiologically regulated by the presence of each other. And that's true in families. So that's one thing that you know, one way in which reading aloud kind of counters the effects of technology. Another is that we are all of us, if, you know, the latest estimates are to be believed, we're all getting shorter attention spans. It's becoming harder for us to concentrate and focus and be fully present in the moment, even when we're not on our machines, because half of our brains have been hijacked by them. And this, again, is a place where reading aloud, engaging with a text, allows the mind to relax, to follow long-form narrative, to create mind pictures, not superficial video pictures, but deep, you know, brain engagement, which, by the way, is incredibly important for children in the early developing years, you know, 1 to 5, when their brains are growing like mad. It's absolutely essential that they not simply have screens. In fact, screens, it appears, are quite deleterious at that age. But this is true not just the, you know, the glory of reading aloud and its benefits in this age of distraction are of use not just to children, not just to adults, but also to people in later years, in older adults. This joining in literature in the sustained way is immensely good for the brain, for the heart, for the imagination. And also language is something which is enhanced by exposure to literature and is attenuated when what we're doing is reacting to symbols and, you know, emojis and things, just dealing online. There isn't that deep engagement with language, the listening, the reading of it. And again, for people at the young end of the spectrum and people at the older end of the spectrum, you know, exercising those language muscles is very important. For children, they're training their language muscles. They're learning about grammar and syntax and vocabulary and context. For people on the older end of the spectrum, it's keeping those muscles, you know, supple. As we age, we sometimes don't open some of our memory files as often as we used to. We don't open our language files as often as we used to. And so engaging again over a book is a way of enlivening these capacities in us. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The attention span really resonates with me as we watch, when we're out somewhere and my wife and I'll be at dinner and we'll look around and everyone at the tables are not looking at each other. They're looking down at their screens. Yeah. And that frustrates me to no end. Yeah. I think it was Hugh Howey that was on the show one time and he said, he was talking about the competition between writers. And, he said, you know, that we're really not competing against each other, in this space. What we're competing against is YouTube and Netflix and whatever the social media du jour, is. We're, you know, we need to band together and encourage people to be reading. Yeah. and you know, read whomever, but get reading, you know, and then we get, that we have a reading public who can enjoy all of our books. But yeah, that's the problem, is it? It's the attention span. We don't stop long enough to absorb what's going on around us, much less stories shared with one another.
Yeah. And it strips the depth out of life. You know, there's that wonderful book, The Shallows, to describe the way that we are all tending. I've forgotten the name of the author. Forgive me. You know, you have a richer experience of life if you stop and look and listen. I mean, it's, you know, in the same way that, you know, you can live on junk food, right? I mean, you're not going to die of junk food, but you have a richer, you certainly have a sort of maybe a healthier and more robust experience of life if your body is getting those deep nutrients that it needs. Well, the same thing is true for our hearts, our spirits, and our brains. If we can live perfectly, you know, adequately with superficial entertainments, but we lose something much deeper when that is what is crowding, you know, when superficial entertainments are in daily ephemera, the latest Twitter wars, whatever, they crowd out more profound experiences and reflections and they crowd out beauty. I mean, I have to say, I think beauty is a big part of this. When children, and there's quite a lot of, I had some, you know, fascinating interviews for the book with doctors and clinicians who are looking at the effects of books versus video on children's brains. You know, they put them in the scanner and they give them different stimuli and they see what happens with the different brain domains. And children who are shown a video, it's all their eyes are taking in what I call the shock and awe, you know, of the visual experience. And it's maybe because we are predator creatures, you know, our eyes are very, very excited by movement and we want to keep watching and we can't help but track the moving image. But deeper engagement isn't happening. You know, there's no moment for reflection. It's just the thing that's happening right in front. And when you give children time to look at pictures, listen to a story, and just give them time, it engages their whole self. You know, it's quite remarkable.
The book is called The Enchanted Hour, The Miraculous Power of Reading Aloud in the Age of Distraction. Megan, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today. The book is out now in hardcover, Kindle edition, even audiobook, which is the perfect way to enjoy this book.
Can I say a plug? I recorded the audiobook.
That's the best.
Boy, it was great. It was tough, but it was great.
It's a different skill, isn't it?
Well, and also, if I'd known that I was actually going to record the audiobook, I think I would have put in half of the obscure proper nouns that I did.
I love it. Megan, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. We're going to send everybody to pick up a copy of The Enchanted Hour. I love what you're doing. I love the work that you're doing. Is there a place that people can connect with you online if they want to learn more about you and your work?
I have a website. It's megancoxgurdon.com, and that's spelled MEGHANCOXGURDON.com. And you can reach me by the book, you know, contact my agent, whatever you like to do on that site.
Fantastic. Megan, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, it was a joy. I loved it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. Find all the archives at hankgarner.com. Now, stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
Hedwig slipped into David's den, the circular reading room. A ladder of crude rungs protruded from the wall, remnant of its days as a grain silo. He pulled himself upward, rung by rung, until the bookcases and sofas were far below. Even if he fell and died, he didn't really care anymore. No, he did care. He couldn't die yet. She had to die first. That would make their divorce final, if she wanted it so much. Darkness enveloped him. He reached the top of the ladder and stepped off onto a catwalk of black mesh, lit only by the faint light of the four square windows that encircled the turret. From this perch he could see the exit she would use. He felt like an assassin, like Lee Harvey Oswald in the window of the Texas Schoolbook Depository. But he wouldn't use a rifle, no. Rifles leave evidence. Rifles can be produced in court. Rifles can miss. He pulled back a shroud of burlap and opened the cardboard box he'd stashed up here earlier that day. He reached into it and withdrew the only murder weapon, the only magic bullet a Van Brunt could ever need. The gold lantern flashed in the moonlight. He held it up to the window. One if by land, two if by sea, he thought. And then it's time for a midnight ride. But it won't be Paul Revere. No, not Paul Revere at all. He found the oyster knife at last. He lay his cupped palm sideways over the vent. Don't get blood on your Armani. and stabbed the blade into his palm. The blood came hot. He dripped it into the lantern, where the skull of the horseman waited to sip it like nectar. The reliquary glowed, and an incantation in Old Dutch appeared, shining from within the metal. It was time. Hedwig bent and whispered into the vents. "Rise, headless, and ride." The letters vanished, and a cold, white light burst from the thing. The skull wasn't just a skull anymore. It had gestated. Capillaries clung to it the way fine hair clings to the crown of a newborn. A thick, carotid artery moved with snake-like undulation, drinking blood from the pool at the base, pulling it upwards to circulate through scarlet vessels, through twisting coils, slurping the liquid greedily, the way little Zeph used to slurp strawberry Nesquik through a crazy straw. The blood pulsed and pushed into the nose, into the eyes, into the hollow cavity within the skull. But was it hollow still? Hedwig didn't think so. He felt a mind growing there, something with a will to challenge his own. He fixed his gaze to the twin caverns of its eye sockets, speaking slowly and deliberately. "Jessica Bridge." The death's head grin broadened somehow, and a thread of black and green liquid, shiny as a horsefly's wings, trickled from the gap of a missing eye tooth. "Only Jessica Bridge. Do you understand?" He shook the lantern. "Do you understand?" The face lurched forward and struck the glass, leaving a red splash there. It wobbled and settled, smiling and nodding.
"Jessica Bridge," hissed the face. "Yes." Hedwig raised the lantern a little. "Jessica Bridge."
The red face tipped backwards and the jaw cracked wide. Hedwig recoiled. Something pink and wet writhed inside that mouth, the nub of a new tongue, salivating as if it could taste the name.
"Jessica Bridge. Jessica Bridge. Jessica Bridge. Jessica Bridge."